assessment tools that they're using and how it's impacting their students, and then they come back for the next topic. The PLCs are what holds us together, when the teachers actually go back and talk about what they're learning. And Deb Ricken is one of our PLC facilitators. So each group, when they go back to their school, has one person that's designated to be in charge, and those PLC facilitators come together for additional training so that they can analyze the data that's been collected in their school. They can ask the questions that are going to get people to think more deeply about what it is they're learning and how it's impacting their students. So I'm going to turn it over to Deb right now so she can talk a little bit more about the data that's being used with the PLCs and the types of discussions that are happening as a result of the training.
Thank you, Ms. Stevenson. We do have a question, I believe, from Representative Swales.
It's not a question, Mr. Chair, but I do want the members to pay very close attention to the language that's being used about PLCs and keep that in mind as we're discussing QCOMP. Professional learning communities as designed by Dr. DeFore are amazing in teacher collaboration. It's weekly, it's ongoing, and what we're hearing right now is the precise model that I think Dr. DeFore had in mind, and I do want us to keep this in mind. It's very effective in teacher development.
Thank you, Representative Wells. It's a good focusing comment for us. Representative Peterson, I believe, has a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much do you use, or how integrated is technology with what you're doing? It seems to me that that's an essential component of the learning, and I'm wondering if you have access and you have the resources to have technology integrated into this learning community.
We have both for the teachers and actually right now for the teachers, we have a website that is our communication tool for teachers so that they use that method of keeping track of their information, having access to their assessment tools, and then sending back the results of their assessment so we can gather them, putting things on the website and so on. Using technology as part of the training piece, trainers are using technology. We're not teaching skills necessarily right now that they will be using with the students. However, part of our charge is to produce, to be sustainable. And so we're producing modules in addition to the algebra module. This is where we would go next. And our region is producing two STEM modules so that we'll integrate the science, technology, engineering, and math in those modules that could be used for training for next year, both elementary and high school. And another region is developing a middle school. So the technology piece, the integrated technology engineering piece is on the books, but we started with our algebra module this year. Did that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, I'm part of it, but I'm also wondering, in terms of integrating the use of technology in working with the students, too, so that that's part of how the students are dealing, learning. And I realize we don't have very much capacity in some places, but I would hope that that's also part of this process.
We're starting to. We're starting to use a piece. For example, one of the in the last day of training, the one that we just finished about pattern generalization, part of what the teachers got were some classroom activities that they can go back and they can do a problem with their students, give them a pattern, and ask them to analyze the pattern and justify their thinking, and then they see a classroom clip of students their own age who have wrestled with that same problem, and they use that as a model to step outside just their classroom and see how other students think and then have discussions around that. So, pieces.
And members, both this committee and Representative Growley's committee have been trying to tackle the issue of getting modern technology more available, you know, at least in terms of the hardware capacities for both of these purposes. And we've, well, Representative Dietrich has also led that. They charged big time, and I think you have a bill even this year to deal with that issue. So we'll be circling back to that as well. Ms. Stevenson, please proceed.
Okay. If there aren't any more questions about the structure, you have a handout that has our picture, our logo, it's in our hands. Math Success is in our hands. So this will go over what I just told you about the structure and the involvement of various people in the within the structure of our training. Just one more thing to note, in addition to Science Museum and SciMath Minnesota, in addition to these 517 teachers coming together consistently throughout the year, we also have required or asked for a commitment from principals from every one of the 59 schools involved in our initiative at the metro area, that they come together throughout the year for a forum series so that we can keep them up to speed on the math that their teachers are learning and ask them to analyze the data at their school as well. We have also asked the curriculum directors and the math specialists from those same districts to commit to coming together for a forum series so they can be up to speed as well. So we have a lot of support for the teachers within their district in addition to the training that they're coming to.
Ms. Stevenson, let me ask, and I don't know to what degree this is an issue, but I suspect that we're talking about a statewide effort here,
mm-hmm.
right? I suspect we have school districts around the state that are configured differently, probably due to capacity issues. So I'm guessing there may be districts where you may not have a math specialist or,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps the curriculum specialist. I'm not sure. How do you interact best with those districts? How can we make sure that all districts are being able to participate effectively in the model that you're developing?
The model is, we all have the same parameters to work around, and that is the 30 hours of training plus having professional learning communities throughout the year for application. But then we're given leeway to work with our constituents, with our people in our region, because we know that in San Francisco, where I grew up, it's you just don't drive to an area to go get training as easily as you do here, as we can have people driving all over the place and we can have meetings constantly. So the PLC model might look a little bit different in some of the regions. In a couple of the regions, they're using the Japanese lesson study model as a tool and bringing their teachers together. They did the training in the summer. So if you have to drive to Bemidji from East Grand Forks or from Cedar River Falls to do your algebra training, they went for the 5 days of training in the summer, where ours is spread out across the year. Then their professional learning communities meet throughout the year, and they may come together as a region quarterly, but within their local area, then we'd have Cedar River Falls, East Grand Forks, Crookston, and so on, coming together more often so that they can drive, they can actually get to their communities. They're also using, I can't speak to the word Moodle, they're using social networking, they're using technology to connect the teachers are in the wider open regions as a part of the requirement for their teachers to connect with one another and have conversations, but they're doing those conversations electronically. So each region is dealing with that geographical issue in their own way as best they can this year, and that's part of what we're going to be talking about when we come together next week at the Department of Education. Each region sends representatives, and we're going to talk about how are your PLCs working, how are they serving your folks, and how are you making that happen. So there will be much more discussion about how can we electronically do this, how do we physically do it, what's the magic combination of actually getting together so you're not doing things only electronically, but using that electronic means to connect as well. So each region is figuring that out, how to make the PLCs be a living, breathing piece of connection for teachers.
That's good to hear, Ms. Stevenson. It I think, reflects a strong Minnesota value, I think, of being very intentional and diligent to make sure that we're not, creating two or three different Minnesotans based on access and opportunity. And so I think we... as a legislature, really striven to press quality statewide for every student in every district in our state. We have a question for Representative Falk, and then I think we'll move on to Ms. Reichen. Is that right?
Ricketts.
Okay, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I look at this, the $1.6 million, 517 teachers, that's approximately $3,000 per teacher, which to me seems like quite a bit. I don't know if it is or not, but that seems like quite a bit. And I know you're doing some other things. Would you be willing to send me a breakdown of where the $1.6 million, and you don't need to do it now, just email that to me when you get a chance, please. Thank you.
And that'd be great. And I'm told that Pat King is also here from the Department of Education. And Pat, certainly feel free to come down if there's a question you think that gets asked or something that isn't said. You know, just jump up and we'll make sure that, that we'll have an opportunity to hear from you. And so you heard the request also from Representative Fowles, but I suspect the department is in a good position perhaps to provide that kind of information. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. King. Ms. Ricken, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representative. My name is Deb Ricken. I am a math teacher and PLC facilitator at Centennial Independent School District Number 12, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. One of the requirements of participating in the Math Academy is that each teacher needs 30 hours of training. And so yesterday, that training centers around those critical understandings that are necessary to move students from arithmetic thinking onto algebraic thinking. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to attend with my colleagues the third day of training, which centered around pattern generalization. And during lunch, I said to them, I'm addressing this group this morning. What words of advice do you have? What are your thoughts? What has this experience done to you? And I gave you a handout. Their insight was wonderful and very profound. So I just jotted down and asked their permission if I could share some of their quotes with you to see what the teachers out there in the trenches are saying about this. Jessica said, I've learned and implemented so many new strategies for teaching the various concepts, and that's helped more of my students to be successful. The strategies provide more students with access points to the concept. Karina said, I'm learning to question students differently in ways that give me better insight into student thinking. Knowing what and how my students think guides me in the next step. Deb said, the time to collaborate using data as the center of the discussion is invaluable. Together, we can figure out which instructional strategies seem to be working best. And Chris said, this has been my best PLC experience. It's so structured, focused, and goal-oriented. I love it. The words of my colleagues. So, as Deb mentioned in her statement, our conversations in our PLCs revolve around data. After every day of training, we go back and have 4-hour-long meetings. In those meetings, we bring in student work, we examine it, we collect data about it, and then we design instructional strategies that are appropriate for what our students know and where they're at. We ask 4 basic questions every time. What do we want students to know? What's it going to look like? What do we do when they don't know it? And what do we do if they do know it? It's based right under the 4 models. So let me give you an example, and I'll be sharing some data about our first day of training, which dealt around the topic of equality. We spent our whole first day talking about the equal sign. And the equal sign, the understanding of equality, is one of those, can be a stumbling block for moving kids into algebra. Because many of us think about the equal sign as meaning an operation of, you need to give an answer. 4 plus 3 is 7. Okay, that's an operational understanding. Get the answer. However, the equal sign really shows a relationship between two things of different value. And if kids don't get that, they can't do algebra. So, as other researchers found, we collected our data, we went back, and guess what? Our kids thought the equal sign meant get the answer. So we began to design instructional strategies for that. And what I put on the back of this is some data after 6 weeks of instruction. Because we're constantly looking at the data. As Cynthia said, we always give a baseline. Everyone in our, all 517 teachers give the same baseline. We collect the data and we happen to look at it. And then we spend some time working on this. Now it's important to understand when you look at this growth that we are not stopping our regular curriculum during this process. We did not teach how to solve two-step equations during this 6 weeks. We simply used every opportunity in what we normally do, every encounter with an equal sign, as an opportunity to think about the equal sign as a relationship between the two. Okay? So let's look at the data. 6th graders. Now, at the beginning of it, this was administered in early October, only 7.1% of our kids could solve a two-step equation, right? That's no surprise. You've never seen a two-step equation, right? Again, we did not explicitly teach them about two-step equations. We just talked about relationships. And 6 weeks later, we had moved that up to nearly 57%. That's amazing.
That is.
Seventh graders. Now, seventh graders didn't show as greater growth, but we were up close to 70%. And they, again, did not have explicit instruction on two-step equations, but they did have some on one-step equations, doing and undoing one step. But many of them were able to apply that anyway in a new situation. Eighth graders, they showed the least growth, but still, we were close to 83%. And the questions continue in our PLCs about equality. What do we do with these 83% of the kids that already know how to do that? How do we extend their thinking? And what are we doing about these 17% still to get them up to snuff, because that's a target for our eighth graders. But this data is very helpful in us in reflecting on that and designing our instructional materials. I'd like to close with some personal observations. I'm really proud to be a teacher in Minnesota. It's a state with such high expectations for all students. But with the new algebra requirement for all in eighth grade, that bar has been raised. It's a changing world, and that's appropriate. But the bar has been raised for me. And I can't keep doing things the way I've always done them. I'm going to get the same result. So the opportunity for me personally to participate in this math academy has been life-changing. I don't do things the way I did for the last 33 years. And neither do the people in my school. It has shifted the culture in our school. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity. I think it's one of the most exciting and promising initiatives that I've seen in my career. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rickon. Very powerful testimony and some proper humility, I think. You know, so you've been teaching for 3 decades, and here you as a good professional are saying, and I recognize that we need to do things differently because we have different goals that are appropriate goals, and here's a wonderful tool that helps me to get there. We do have a couple questions from Representative Demmer and Representative Depke. No? You good? Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I love it when teachers talk about how they love being teachers in Minnesota, and it's just great to hear your enthusiasm. I have a general question on the PLC program in as a whole, because we've heard several people talk in these committees about how wonderful the PLC program is, and we heard testimony from the Department of Education earlier saying that the PLC program is being used by some districts to help them work towards their QCOMP requirements and in the program. Could anyone comment on that? Do you see that there's a conflict of having PLC and in a school district in addition to being a QCOMP school? Do you feel that it's a harmonious combination of the two?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say that I'm a professional learning community in my school. We are a QCOMP school as well. They are totally compatible. It's the same structure, the same model. In fact, this has helped us to transfer some of those skills because the Math Academy has been very intentional about training us as facilitators with some excellent staff development and facilitation tools. So those of us that are in multiple situations have transferred those skills and those techniques to other settings. So it's excellent.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Zepke. And now for Dr. Ono, for Mike Lindstrom. So, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Lindstrom. I'm with SciMath Minnesota as their executive director. My role in the math teacher academies is I am one of the trainers. And what I'd like to provide you with is a specific look at the change that I've seen in teachers as I've worked with them throughout this year. Because the bottom line is you can have a great plan, but if it doesn't translate to classroom practice, you're not going to make a difference for students. and it's the change in classroom practice that has really impressed me. I just retired from the Anoka-Hennepin School District in June. Spent the last 16 years there in the district office in a variety of positions, but working primarily with staff development with a variety of groups. And so I've spent a lot of my life working with teachers and staff development. And what I see in this model, I'm going to give you a specific example of the change that I've seen taking place. The very first day that we pulled in almost 600 teachers from the metro into the convention center, and we presented the first concept, and Deb talked about that, the concept of equality. And I will tell you that when I looked out there at the teachers, and I read the body language, and then I met with a group of them afterwards in my portion of the training, you could tell that, especially for 8th grade and 7th grade teachers, the concept of equality seemed just to be a little too basic. That, you know, maybe we weren't setting the bar quite high enough. And the model, though, what the model did is the model looked at the research to see where the key understandings had to be to get kids to algebra in grade 8 and what the misconceptions were that prevent kids from getting there. And that research then was translated into a pretest that all the teachers from this first session went back with and administered to their students. Then the research followed up with an intervention. So once you now know how pervasive the problem is in your classroom and which kids need intervention, what do you do? So the model provided that intervention for the teachers. Then with the PLC model, it set up a structure where they could meet, talk together about what they found in their pretest, talk together about what they were doing in the intervention, and the model also provided a post-test so that they could see if there was, in fact, any difference made, because we need to document the difference if we're going to be accountable in this system. So that was the model. And I will tell you that the next day of training, when the teachers came back, the attitude had changed 180 degrees. Because you all know kids can find ways to sort of stay under the radar screen. And they were slipping through classes without these skills, and now teachers knew just how pervasive that misunderstanding was. Mm. And they had been able to address that with the information that had been provided, and they had been able to document the progress. And the attitude when they came back for that second day of training, ready now to look forward to the next intervention, the next big understanding, the next pretest and post-test. This is a very good model. It's very powerful. And I believe it's not only replicable, this could be taken out to virtually any school. It's not heavily dependent on the trainers. Once the materials are there, the model can be taken anywhere, and it can be sustained. This is something that the PLC model does not need to necessarily have continual infusion of funding. Once it's established in a building, this can continue on and sustain itself. So I think it's an extremely powerful model.
Thank you, Dr. Lindstrom. Are there any questions or comments, Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindstrom, I'm just wondering if the type of assessments, do you have like a rapid assessment that you do? What is it? How do you, what is your pre and post test? Or assessment that you use?
Dr. Lindstrom.
Yes, the pre and post test has been designed, at least in the metro area, by Terry Weibert from the University of Minnesota and his team, who were looking at the original research, and they are paper and pencil copies. And so we distribute copies of these to the teachers that are then placed on the website, so if they take notes on there, they can go get a clean one right away and duplicate these for students. The post test is the same sort of model. Yes.
Representative Dietrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think these academies are great. I think that it sounds like you have focused on something and done it very well in very high quality, and I applaud that. It reminds me a little bit of when I went and watched the TAP school. Is that what it's called, TAP? We used to be TAP school? Yours. The TAP used to be? Anyhow, we went and observed a TAP school, and they focused on one concept, synonym. And, I mean, they beat those things to death, in my opinion. And I said to myself, wow, the cost of teaching a synonym really just got extremely expensive. You could say that with the equal sign, if you so chose to take that route. So the question for me is, what is stopping us from teaching these concepts, this way of teaching, this way of looking at math? What is stopping us from doing that in the higher ed institution? In my opinion, when a person spends 4 years in college to become a math teacher, that these are the strategies that they ought to be learning right out of the box, instead of coming to a school district and then taking it using our school district money or our state money that should be going into the classrooms. What are the obstacles? Or maybe we've started down that path.
Yes, Stephen.
I'd like to address that. I think that the higher ed institutions are beginning to teach this way, or are starting to teach this way. This is a case of you only know what you know. And the research that's been done in the past 5 years around algebra and how algebra is a gatekeeper to problem solving. If you want a job in any area that involves technology, engineering, and the math and science, and if you want a higher level job, you have to be able to think relationally. You have to be a problem solver. And so there's a lot of research that's happened to say, why is it that we're only reaching that 20% of students who take higher level math? What is it that they're not understanding? And until the research is done, until we get a focus like this, we do lots of staff development. We do lots of training for teachers, and we went through, I have almost a major in math from college, because I liked it, and I took lots and lots of classes. But what I learned then was what the current thinking was then. The research wasn't being done for elementary school, for what is it they're not understanding when they're in first grade and second grade that's causing the stoppage. And I think the focus on accountability that's happened in the past number of years has forced us to take a much closer look at how are we going to get into the heads of every single student, rather than if you like math, you're going to learn a lot more math. So the cost is the research. The cost is the time. It's people with a focus to say, what information can we give to those people who are now in public schools teaching children? And there's a lot of expense there, time and information. So I would say the reason we haven't done this, that I wasn't taught as an elementary teacher to be able to teach the equal sign differently than the way I learned it, is we didn't know. We didn't know that was such a big problem. And so all of the research that's going on at those higher ed institutions is helping us. And I think that is one of the three things that I think is absolutely the most powerful part about this model. One is the collaboration between higher ed and K-12. Now we can get the information from them so we can build up the students at the same time they're teaching teachers. So that in their teacher education programs, they are talking about this. But that's not helping us. So we need to catch up, and we need to catch up quickly. The other thing is the PLC model. We didn't know about that until Rick DeFore burst out of Illinois and said, here's what happened in our school that made a difference, that got the teachers talking to each other. This has made a huge difference. So we didn't know about that. Now we know about that. So now we're trying to implement that starting right away at elementary. And in 5 years, hopefully PLCs will be just normal. That's just part of our operating procedure. And algebra will be something that, of course, students know. Now we can push them higher. We can work, you know, at a much higher level. So the K-12 collaboration, the PLC model, and then the support. That very often in the past we've sent teachers off to a class, go take a class or go take a workshop about math, about doing something in math, and come back and do what you can do in your classroom. But we're opening everything up and saying the principal needs to know what's going on. The principal needs to know about this research, and saying this is really important that your teachers have time to talk about this. The curriculum director or the person who can serve in that area. The science museum, we need to take advantage of the resources and the materials at the science museum. Everybody needs to know how important it is for kids to get a basic understanding of mathematics starting from kindergarten. So it is expensive, and it would be nice if we knew now what we're going to need to know 10 years from now, but we don't. We're learning constantly, and that's That's kind of the nature of education. We don't know what we're going to need 5 years from now, but we're going to keep learning and opening and keeping ourselves open and saying, okay, what's next? What's next that we can help them with?
Members, we're going to move on. I know there's more questions, but Dr. Schmidt has joined us. I want to make sure we have time for all our testifiers today. I want to thank you three for teaching us this, today and sharing, I think, some very good news about our state's bold embracing of striving for higher levels of quality in our science and math expectations out of our K-12 system. It seems to me that that for teachers, we have tended primarily to talk about, raising the content knowledge, whatever we can in terms of policy, to help teachers and teacher candidates to do that. And that's a proper thing to do. But I'm also hearing very strongly that, in addition to that, that there are issues with just awareness for teachers, that this whole concept of creating supportive communities that can drive both, that content acquisition, but more importantly, for those already in the field, this awareness and this spirit of embracing new techniques that can match with these new bold goals that we have. And I'm also, Dr. Lindstrom, not forgetting your comment that, once you've got these PLCs going, you're not necessarily talking about constantly, infusing dollars. I think that's important for us to keep in mind. I know Representative Greiling and the members of her committee here heard that comment loud and clear as well. So thank you so much for the work that you do, and I look forward to continuing to hear from you and your community as you continue with this bold, aggressive, but important agenda. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Next, I'm going to keep the order that we're at because we've heard reference to the Science Museum several times, so I want the Science Museum folks to come up, and we'll try to split up the rest of our time. We're done at 10 between the Science Museum testimony and then our guest from out of state, Dr. Schmidt. So welcome, Liesl Chatman. It's good to see you again.
Good morning.
Please state your name for our records, and then we're in your hands for the next 15 minutes or so.
Okay. I am Liesl Chatman. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Science Museum of Minnesota. I'm joined by my colleague, Larry Thomas. If you've been to the Science Museum, familiar with our programs, you know that we can't go anywhere without stuff. So Larry's going to help me manage stuff so that I can be next to the microphone. I've been coached about how I need to aim the microphone.
Very important.
But that I can still give you a sense of how we work. And so my goals in talking with you this morning is not only to give you a live, breathing sense of how we work, but then to put that in the context of the accomplishments of the investment that the state of Minnesota has put into the Science Museum. I'd like to begin really by just letting you know that we are a community. When I walked in this morning, I saw all my friends and colleagues from Lakeville, from Centennial, from TriMath Men, from the Department of Education, that we work together. It was great to see them. We are not competing with each other. We are not at odds with each other. We, in fact, are on the same page in a focused direction. So I just want to underscore that aspect of these investments. One of the things that we are working very carefully in the professional development department at the Science Museum is helping to translate the very best in research into really pragmatic practices that teachers can put into their teaching. And you heard, this is just perfect, we didn't plan it this way, but I can put the equal sign, the relationship, into context. And I think that's where I'd like to start. We, in our work with MUSE, which is Materials and Understanding for STEM Educators, that's the name that we've given the effort that you have invested in, and that I as a taxpayer have invested in, that we developed four guiding principles for MUSE. And those guiding principles are that science, technology, engineering, and math need to be taught in a highly integrated approach. One guiding principle. Second guiding principle is that when you put forth effort, you get smarter. Sounds simple, but it's key to math and science. Because in math and science, you do experiments, and they fail over and over and over again. Edison tried about 1,000 experiments before he got a light bulb to light. And we need that kind of approach for the energy problems that we have, for the math involved in the economic crisis, all of those kinds of things. You need to be persistent and resilient and put forth effort. If we have a view of intelligence that I was born with everything I got right at the beginning, the IQ kind of approach, and that if I try hard, if I have to try hard, that means I'm not smart, that is really fundamentally at odds with the habits of mind that you need in the STEM discipline. So effort-based learning. Third guiding principle is to approach the achievement gap, which Minnesota has one of the worst in the country. So I am prideful as a Minnesotan about the general achievement that we have in our education system and in the STEM discipline, and I'm deeply troubled about the achievement gap that we have since our Marshall, Minnesota, over 1,000% increase in students of color. These students are our future, and we need to do a good job with them. So looking at cultural relevancy and cultural competency for teaching our increasingly diverse students. The last guiding principle is looking at a systems-based approach, and the Math and Science Teacher Academies are a system-based approach. Looking at standards is a system-based approach. Looking at the context of a district is a system-based approach. So those four things. So now I'd like to get out some toys to show you what that might look like. These are the red boxes from Science House. And Science House is our resource center. The kids get excited when they see these red boxes come in. Teachers who are members of Science House can check these materials out with their library card, and they get a big box of cool stuff to take out. Representative Mariani and Representative Greiling visited and saw these materials. Any of you can stop in at Science House anytime between 3:30 and 6:30 any day of the week to see this. So I got to go back to the microphone. These are Minnesota animals that we're getting out here. And we've got a goat. Larry's getting out next to the pig. It's like a puzzle. Get the pig. Next he's going to get out a moose. And then he's going to get out a cougar. We have 250 different species of animal results that teachers can check out and take into this classroom. Okay, so I got the moose. The relationship between science, technology, engineering, and math. Two fast definitions. I started out as an elementary school teacher in the arts, so I never assumed that anyone is well-versed in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Science is the study of the natural world. Patterns found in nature and understanding those patterns sufficiently so that you can predict what will happen in the future. You can predict whether you send an Apollo rocket into space, whether it will actually make it to the moon and back again. Predict the future in the natural world. Mathematics is the study of pattern and abstraction. And it uses a symbolic language. That symbolic language includes numbers, the equal sign, but looks at patterns. Engineering harnesses the knowledge from those two disciplines and uses it to solve problems that people face. Technology then is the tools of those that then extend our thinking, extend our senses, extend our strength, and use to solve those problems as well. That's just a brief overview. So why do I have these goals here? How does this help us with STEM integration? And starting with biology, we all have a salt in our head. And if we look at the jaw, and we look at the relationship, the relationship, Mike, between the hinge of the jaw and the line of the teeth and the whole length of the jaw. You can see that this kind of makes a triangle, okay? With this as the top of the triangle.
So with this moose, if I look at this fig, I've got a long triangle that's not that tall. If I say the cougar, I can see, here's the hinge. You see, wow, that's just about level with the tooth line. And that this is a very short triangle. If I look at the pig, it's just so fun to look at. If I look at the pig, there are pigs. They're big. Look at the mass of this. I mean, they're just extraordinary. And you know, we all know what a pig is. It's not an exotic animal. So, but if I look at the pig, here's the hinge, jawline. That I've got kind of all of these, kind of the most square, if I took the triangle and the most square. So let's pretend that I had not only a moose, but a caribou and an elk and a deer and this goat and all sorts of animals like that. And I plotted that out and I grabbed that information. And then I had all the cats, but not only cats, I had other stuff that ate meat. Well, pigs, they've got teeth just like ours. They're omnivores. They eat everything. Those of you that have any experience with pigs know they eat everything. Bears are like that too. And if I plotted that out, herbivore eats plants, total meat eater. Those of you with cats who get into your robins and things like that, meat eaters. Garbage, everything. And I graph this out. Carnivores, red. Herbivores, green. I like color coding. Omnivores, such as us, we're primates. I mean, as primates, we're omnivores. And I put all those dots there. Of the length of that, the height here versus this height. Okay? And I plot that out. I actually see that the carnivores all have that short relationship. The herbivores really long and tall, and the omnivores in between. This is algebra. This is algebra. These are linear equations, and algebra is about linear relationships. That equal sign is a linear relationship. Calculus is a nonlinear relationship. That's where you have a curved line, not a straight one. Okay? We've got the guiding principles working here. Okay? We're integrating science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We could take this further and say, okay, based on this graph, I would like you to engineer some scissors that cut things the way that a dog cuts things. Can you use what you've learned here to engineer something that then comes out in a technology class? Okay. There's relevancy here for English language learners, for Ojibwe students, for Somali students. When we bring a goat skull into classes in Minneapolis, the Somali kids, oh, I know what that is. That's a goat. I was a goat herder in Africa. A farm kid is going to know what a pig is. Ojibwe students, they know the word moose is an Algonquin word. That means big twig eater. Moose are big twig eaters. Scrape off the bark. And that word is contained, that meaning, that knowledge is contained in their language. So you're putting this into context for your students. And that we're focusing on standards and concepts that prepare kids for 8th grade algebra. So we're focused on standards in that system. So I wanted to bring light to, when I talk about these guiding principles, this is the kind of work that we're talking about. So, now that you have a crash course in this, if we were doing this with teachers or kids, this would take a week. So you've gotten the Julia Child statement that's really fast. Okay?
We do this in support of the Math and Science Teacher Academy. So we've been to Mankato, Thief River Falls, Rochester, Winona, Duluth. We've been to all these places augmenting the Math and Science Teacher Academy, doing this kind of work with them, so that the rigorous things that they're learning in their PLCs about math concepts then have this broader relationship to the quantitative disciplines of science, engineering, and technology. We also have then programs that work with teacher leaders at a district level. So Deb is involved in a program called Nexus that works with STEM leaders. And we have that Venn diagram right over there. Now, I'm 50, and that's a little bit hard for me to read, so I'm going to read it out loud. Thank you, Larry. So, Larry, you're so helpful to have here. So on this side, you see district and university leadership. Nexus is a program that's co-funded by Muse Fund and by the Medtronic Foundation. Medtronic started with the metro area. Muse enabled us to enlarge the whole state. When we started, the first year of Nexus had 25 participants and 14 districts. The second year, 17 districts, 44 participants. This past year, with state funding, we had 82 participants, 23 districts, including Moorhead, Bemidji, St. Cloud, Winona, Rochester, St. Louis County. And so that allowed us to broaden out to the whole state and have a pilot for three MinSCU campuses. So to the question about what happens with the teaching for pre-service teachers, we have MinSCU faculty members, mathematicians, going through and seeing how to work with SOLS in this context. That affects how they work with their undergraduate and graduate students. So that program is called Nexus Leadership. Then the professional development, I think we have a sense of what we do when we work with folks. The difference between what we do with classroom teachers and what we do in Nexus with the leadership level is that in Nexus we're talking about how do you make this happen for your whole district, what are the things that you need to know about working with adults that's different from working with kids, so adult pedagogy, and then classroom materials and support. You've got a glimmer of the kinds of things that Science House holds that teachers check out. We had one teacher yesterday said, you know, the kids just get so excited when they see the red box. You know, because they're filled with, like, you know, a pizza. I wanted to show you one last thing from Science House that will be germane to what Dr. Schmidt is going to talk about. And that is working with teachers to align what they're doing, to crystallize and pinpoint, to make sure they're working on the right concepts at the right grade level with the right sequence of concepts. This book was developed by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. It has filled with maps of standards that let you know this is kindergarten, 3 through 5, 6 through 8, 9 through 12. And right now I just happened to look at the flow of energy in ecosystems. It has standards and benchmarks, and it has how they're related to each other throughout the grade level. So that as a teacher I can say, oh, I'm working on this concept. I understand that it's related to these other concepts. If I don't teach this, it's going to undermine what my colleagues at upper grade levels are working on. This blue bar is research on how kids learn this concept. And so this is like, teachers love this because it's simple. They don't need to read an entire book. They can go through and use it. There's two volumes of this book. Each one of these volumes costs $50 a piece. They are accompanied by other standards documents, the principles for school mathematics from the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, the work from the National Research Council, and several books that each cost about $50 a piece. A collection of these standards books is about $500. Teachers get those books, they're overwhelmed by them. We have both a protocol
to work with teachers and readers so that they can in turn work with their teachers on how to use these books to have coherency and alignment of standards that Dr. Schmidt will underscore with great vigor, and how to use them. And then we've got 80 sets of those books so that an entire district could check them out for a staff development day. We can teach them how to use it. They can keep them for 2 weeks and use them. That investment right there is $40,000 that we have to share those resources. So one of the things that's great about the approach of Science House is that these resources that would be too expensive for a district or a school to purchase are shared among all these different districts and across the state, and that they have the training to go with it. And it may be that they can't afford it. It may be that, geez, I only need this material once a year, and it's the best material for that time of year, but I can't afford to have it sit on the shelf. So we maximize those kinds of materials circulating. So Science House, Nexus, and then Professional Development Institutes for Teachers, where we run week-long intensive experiences for 25 teachers at a time in Science House, in that environment. We have scholarships for teachers from Greater Minnesota. We cover all their expenses, and then we're able to travel to them during the school year. So I wanted to give you a sense of that footprint. I'm right there, Larry.
You're a good man, Larry.
Larry and I are a good one. So bottom line, because of this systemic approach, we're reaching about 340,000 students. That's over 40% of the students in Minnesota, and we're just a year and a half into this effort. It's at a cost of less than $9 a student. So we think that we are really a cost-effective investment. We're around the state. We're ready to go. I've been in professional development in leadership positions at universities, districts, museums since the early 90s, and this is the best work that I have seen in my 20-25-year history. We've got the right people. We've got a focus. We are ready to go. And so the investments that you make in these programs together, I think, are really going to be harnessed towards STEM literacy in the state, and that it's important for our fiscal future, it's important for our intellectual future, it's important for our old age, for the kids that are going to take care of us to understand these things. So so I thank you for the time. I know that you're going to enjoy Dr. Schmidt, and I'm deeply appreciative of your support.
Thank you, Ms. Chapman, and thank you, Mr. Thomas. I am going to move us into the next testimony. I suspect that your presentation generated a number of questions, but hopefully we'll be able to do wrap those up with questions with Dr. Schmidt. Yes, and I would encourage members to do that. Representative Greiling and I did visit there, and we were blown away with a much longer presentation. And I want to thank you for sharing with us this notion of the integrated approach with STEM. And I have to say very quickly, one of the things that I was very struck with when I visited there was just the power of the relevancy of this approach given the diversity of income and culture and races in our state. We heard testimonies from you have videotaped testimonies with some of the learning community reflections, and I was just taken by how the application of these methodologies and this thinking created the kind of space where students in many districts who were often sort of relegated to the margins, thought of as perhaps not quite capable by their peers, perhaps even by their instructors, wound up pretty quickly and excitedly engaged in STEM pursuits, and in fact became leaders in their classrooms. Just a powerful transformative way for us to deliver education in the state of Minnesota that you're helping to deliver with the systems-based approach and in coordination with our SciMath Academy. So thank you again, and hopefully we'll have some good questions for you at the end of Dr. Schmidt's presentation as well. Dr. Schmidt,
Good to see you again. I mistook you for Dr. Lindstrom early. I just breezed in here and started a committee right away. I'm looking right at Dr. Lindstrom, and he's looking at me like, what's wrong with this chairperson? But I understood you had some challenges with our airlines and
the weather.
Oh, there's the weather. Okay. Well, welcome. It's good to see you again. Look forward to your testimony. Please state your name for our record, and then we're in your hands, or are you starting us off?
I'm starting, just very briefly, and then I'm going to leave and dash over to the Senate, where Dr. Schmidt is scheduled to meet to speak at 10, and to let them know that he'll be just a few minutes
late. We will adjourn at 10. I'd like to allow a little bit of time for some questions for Dr. Schmidt, and perhaps for our colleagues for the Senate as well. So please proceed, Mr.
My name is Cindy Frith. I'm usually here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, but I'm here today as the chair of the board of SciMath Minnesota. And I just wanted to let you know that if you're not familiar with SciMath, we're a nonprofit partnership among P12, higher ed business, and other partners working to support high quality STEM teaching and learning in Minnesota. We operated for about a decade with generous support from the legislature that allowed us to pay for Minnesota to participate in TIMSS as a mini nation in 1995. To work with districts to use that data to inform data-driven decision-making, to develop math and science frameworks that we like to think is part of what generated the wonderful results about which Dr. Schmidt is going to talk today, and also to implement that Transforming Teacher Education Initiative that focused on many of the issues that you've been discussing over the last 2 days. And I was going to say a few sentences about that, but in the interest of time this morning, I won't. I just want to say that the work that SciMath has done in this area is very consistent with the issues with which you've been grappling, wanting to be sure that teachers are well prepared before they begin their practice in classrooms, and that we don't license them until we've had multiple assessments to know that they're ready to go. So, unfortunately, we no longer enjoy the level of support that we used to get from the legislature that enabled us to do some of this great work that we did. But we were able to put together with a number of business and other partners the support so that Minnesota could again participate as a mini nation in TIMSS. We've seen some great results that I think wouldn't have happened if we didn't have teachers in classrooms with the skills and abilities to implement the standards they were given. And so Dr. Schmidt will tell you more about that now. And I will beg your pardon and scoot over to the Senate so that they know that we're coming shortly.
Thank you, Ms. Frith, and welcome again, Dr. Schmidt.
Thank you. Do I have to say my name? Or?
Yes, it's a quirky custom of ours here in Minnesota.
All right. My name is William Schmidt. I'm a university distinguished professor at Michigan State University and almost a Minnesotan, as I spend a lot of time in the state working with SciMin math and science work and so forth. It's a pleasure to be here, and in the limited amount of time, you have these overheads in front of you, but I'm going to have to skim across them fairly quickly. I want to get 5 points across to you. Basically, I want to say, how did Minnesota students do in 2007? Secondly, how does that compare with the first time point when they were measured in 1995? There's a very nice story there. The third point I want to make is that the standards that began shortly after the 95 study are a major part of this. The fourth point is that the teachers and their work and how they have come to actually embrace those standards and work with them carefully has a major part of this story as well. And then finally, the challenge for all of you, which is that you are doing well, but you are leaving a large segment of your population behind, the issues of inequality. Let me just begin by saying why this is really important. There's a new, you all know this deep in your hearts, but there's a study out now that shows, in effect, what economists have been saying for a long time is not quite correct. They used to say that the number of years of schooling was related to how well a nation did in its economic growth. That is, those nations where kids went to school longer had larger economic growth from year to year. The new study says it's not the number of years of schooling, it's what they know as they leave schooling. And importantly, it says it is not just enough to educate your elite, those kids who will become the leaders, the scientists, etc. But in order to get this economic growth, it is imperative that you educate the entire population. You raise the literacy in science and mathematics for all of the society and their knowledge they carry when they finish their schooling. So, with that as the backdrop for this, you already know part of this story. It was released, I can't even remember, a month or 2 months ago. And basically it says that Minnesota has done very well. I think what you can be particularly proud of is that the story has reached a national interest. It is touted and talked about, and I am contacted just yesterday by somebody who wants to put the story of Minnesota in their newsletter. So I think it is important, not just what I'm going to say for Minnesota, but it's a story I think that is one for the United States as a whole, because it's a story that says, yeah, we can do it. We just have to follow certain principles which we learned from all of this work. Well, to the first point, how did Minnesota do? Well, I'm going to focus just on mathematics, because that's really where the story is. In science, we did about the same as 12 years ago. Not bad, but there's no improvement. In mathematics, you can see from this slide that's before you that Minnesota performed quite well. They outperformed the U.S., and they performed just below the top-achieving countries. This is a pretty remarkable position for them to be. Minnesota and Massachusetts, essentially indistinguishable in their performance, really perform much like those top-achieving countries. So that's the story that's the story at fourth grade, where we came very close to that. At eighth grade, we are just below the top-achieving countries, but in fact, it's a little bit further away from that top-achieving set of countries. The second point I want to make to you is what happened from 1995 to 2007. I think that's an important story in particular for Minnesota, because in 95, when this study was done, Minnesota did not have state standards. They came out shortly thereafter. And so between 1995 and 2007, Minnesota made a major change. It moved to a very fine set of state standards. So what happened over those 12 years? Well, Minnesota made a huge gain. There were gains in not all the countries. These are only the countries that participated in both 95 and 2007. And of those 16 countries, there were very few that actually had gains over those years. And Minnesota's was the third largest gain of all the nations that participated from 95 to 2007. And the gain for Minnesota, as you can see, are moving from 516 to 554, was a gain that was over three times as large as the gain for the United States as a whole. So this is a remarkable performance. This is a remarkably large gain by anybody's standards, and is a major part, I think, of the story, because the last revision of your state standards occurred in 2003. Counted out, 4 years later, they would be fourth graders, and these are the fourth graders. So there's, I think, a strong linkage in that argument. The eighth grade from 95 to 07, there is an improvement in the performance. The performance, though, is not as high, it's not as large. But these standards, the more challenging, rigorous, coherent standards you put in place, have not been in place long enough necessarily to influence these students. They would have been influenced by previous versions. But it is important to note that there was a gain. Minnesota again went from 518 to 532. And you saw on the earlier slide that put them in a category above the U.S., outperforming the U.S., and just performing below the top tier, but at a much larger level of being behind than was the case at the fourth grade. But nonetheless, there is gain at the eighth grade. So the story in mathematics is quite a nice story. You've gained over those 12 years, remarkably so at fourth grade, and at eighth grade you're moving in the right direction. The question then is the third point. Well, what are some of the reasons one might entertain that you might want to continue doing? Well, one is the standard. What we've learned in all the work that we've done is that there are three major principles that characterize the curricula, the standards of these top-achieving countries: coherence, focus, and rigor. Rigor means it gets more difficult as you move to eighth grade. It's about algebra and geometry, not about arithmetic. Focus means you try to focus in on a few topics, cover them thoroughly, deeply, and don't try to do 30 topics in 1 year. Do maybe 4 or 5 topics in a year. So just really get it, so you don't have to keep repeating it year after year and have a lot of redundancy in your curriculum. Coherence has to do with the fact that it's not our, you know, these topics in math or science are not arbitrary. You can't just move them around like pieces of a chess game. Well, even chess has rules. But you can't just move them around arbitrarily. You have to actually, there's a sequence in which they make sense logically from the point of view of the discipline of mathematics. And so standards that are more coherent as opposed to just sort of a catch can sort of approach seem to be characterized those of the top achieving countries. Here's what it looks like. You don't have to dwell on it, but you see that pattern? The ones at the bottom of the list are only covered after the ones at the top of the list are covered. The columns of the eighth grade, the topics are ordered in the fashion that does reflect this kind of coherence. So this is what the top achievers do. This is what influenced Minnesota. They continuously gave us their standards and said, how are we doing? We benchmarked them against this international benchmark of top achieving countries, and that led to the development of the standards in Minnesota. And they came out quite nicely. Just to give you a sense of how bad things can get, this is what it looks like for much of the United States. You have dots everywhere in this pattern. There is no pattern. This is a philosophy to teach everything everywhere because somehow somebody will learn something somewhere. And I suggest to you that's a particularly lame philosophy for curriculum development. But that has been the U.S. approach. Minnesota broke through that, and your standards look more like these than they do the set that's on this page here. Whatever happened there. So that's my third point, that those standards make and likely have made a major difference in all of this. The fourth point I want to make is that you can put standards out, and this is an important point, especially in tight financial times. You can put standards out there, but what you have to do is get the teachers to understand how to follow them, because the coherence will only translate to the kids as it comes through the teacher. Now, you as a legislature funded, together with the business community, the development of frameworks to help the teachers know how to do the standards back in 97. And so that probably had an impact on all of this in what I'm going to show you. But, you know, those have changed now. Your new standards don't have those frameworks. Those would need support. And I would encourage you as an outsider with no vested interest that that is an investment that is worthwhile. Because look at these results that come up here. We took the 95 teachers and the 2007 teachers. We asked them what they did, how they spent their time. If you look at this slide really quickly, the big blue area is what they should be focusing on at fourth grade. It's about number, fractions, decimals, percent, things that fourth grade around the world are taught. If you'll notice, in 1995, it was about a third of the school year. In 2007, the teachers, following the new standards, which emphasize correctly number, you've got almost two-thirds of the school year being focused on there. That's likely one of the big impacts on those gains, because the teachers are actually teaching what kids should be focusing on. It's coherent that they be doing that grade level, and you saw that terrific gain and the jump in performance by the fourth graders. It also then just shows, this one shows you that it lines up with the tests that they took, and the test reflects what the world does, so you're all lined up in that respect. Eighth grade, the story is actually a very nice story, which suggests you're in the right direction. If you look at this thing, that's sort of, these things create all these funny colors, it's sort of red to me. But that reddish color, if you look over in 95, that's algebra. That's what the rest of the world teaches. I heard just at the tail end of some of these conversations about algebra, and it's important. It's darn important. It's the segue to serious mathematical reasoning. It's not that you remember what a quadratic equation is. It's that you've gone through the training that forces your mind to think very quantitatively, analytically. And the world recognizes this. This is the substance of eighth grade, is algebra and geometry. In 1995, you pathetically, your teachers only taught about 10% of the whole eighth grade school year was focused on algebra. 10%. Whereas by contrast, it's somewhere between half to two-thirds in the rest of the world. Look at 2007. It's now virtually half of the school year. That's a big change, and I suggest to you that's probably going to foreshadow change that will take place. I also mentioned to you focus, and you can see that sort of brownish one. That's what in 95, what I call clutter. This is stuff that shouldn't be being covered.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, it's just a bunch of stuff. As a mathematician, it defies my logic. I only know the word to call it stuff. And I call it clutter because it's stuff that should be not in the curriculum. It took up a major, about a third of the school year in 95. By 2007, it was trivial. It was a percent. So focus, coherence came into place at both fourth and eighth grade, and subsequently those good achievement results. I leave you with my fifth point. which is, that's great, folks. But when you look at the actual performance of the different subgroups within your society, when you look at the schools that have a very high minority and the schools that are low social class, with a large percentage of kids on free and reduced lunch, their education with respect to this slide, what kind of emphasis they're getting, and their performance is more third world. In fact, for your kids at the lowest level of social class, their performance is at about the level of Romania and Bosnia-Herzegovina. So this tells you this is not acceptable, especially if you take my first point that the economists are now saying it isn't enough to educate those kids that live in the suburbs that may well end up to be the kids that know the most. That's inadequate. It's not just morally desirable that all kids should have the same opportunity, but it's also economically really necessary for a society, for Minnesota to grow. You need to educate those kids as well as give them the same level playing field. It isn't fair, I can tell you. Their opportunities are not the same as the kids who live in your wealthy suburbs. That, to me, is wrong. It's unconscionably, it's morally wrong. And it's economically stupid, to put it bluntly. So that's your challenge for the next round. You're doing well. You're on the right track. Don't back off the standards you've built. Don't back off the high school graduation things that you've put in place. These are where you need to go. Don't back off 8th grade algebra for all kids. You know, the rest of the world does it. You explain to me why it is Minnesotan kids, some can't do it. I don't accept that. When virtually everywhere in the rest of the world, even in the developing countries, this is the basis of 8th grade mathematics. Thank you for your
time. Thank you, Dr. Schmidt. Quick thoughts on Algebra 2 and geometry, either mastery or something short of mastery in terms of a required expectation of our
all children should take through Algebra 2. I think that's the wave of the future. That's where it needs to go, at least through Algebra 2. Michigan has just initiated legislation that requires 4 years of mathematics, which includes up through Algebra 2 and then one more course. I think that's the way we need to go. We simply cannot continue to put our children at a disadvantage. This is what the rest of the world does. Our kids, by the time they leave 8th grade, are 2 years behind in substance covered. And they don't make it up in high school. That's why the rest of the world considers our first 2 years of college as high school. So, unless we deal with this, jobs will continue to go elsewhere. Not just because they pay cheaper wages, but because the average high school graduate is equivalent to at least our college graduates, if not, and certainly our community college graduates. And we can't continue in that direction if we want to give our children a shot in this world.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Inspirational words, and I appreciate it, but there's a little voice in the back of my head that recognizes that a lot of European countries have a tiered system.
Not during the first 8 years of schooling.
But what about those last four? Are all European kids really going through, or kids from other countries, going through Algebra 2, or is it their elite that are going through Algebra 2?
It depends on the country. Basically, that's not an argument that plays very well anymore, because more and more these countries are requiring of all of their children, even the kids that are in the German system that are tracked in the Hauptschule as opposed to the Gymnasium, they have requirements that include a couple, 3 years of mathematics, which takes them through. Keep in mind that those students in those countries, by the time they graduate 8th grade, have virtually had the equivalent of our Algebra 1 and our geometry class. So when they take a course in high school, maybe if it's only one, it's probably already Algebra 2. We are so far behind coming into high school that it's no longer comparable. Well, first of all, I can't answer your question directly because nobody teaches Algebra 2. They teach mathematics each year, which includes algebra, functions, geometry, and as it gets further up in the system, some calculus as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
And Doctor, you'd also then say that we're even further behind with the fastest growing segment of our student population, kids of color, ELL children, low income children.
Unfortunately, the data show that. And what I think is particularly important, we all know social class plays a role in this. It starts way back at birth. In fact, the latest data I've seen shows that on a first cohort, by about a year on what they could measure developmentally, physically and mental development, there are no differences, but by 2 years there are already big gaps due to social class and racial differences. So that's there. But I think what happens is that you can see it in your data, it's true in the U.S. data as a whole. Those kids are not getting the same quality of education. They're not getting the same opportunities. We don't even give them the opportunity to learn the same stuff that kids in other areas of our society do get the opportunity to learn. So how can they succeed when we don't even give them the opportunity? That's why I suggest the system is not a level playing field, which is what we think in America. We want to believe that our system is the way up and out, but it's not anymore. I'm writing a book. This is not a commercial.
Available on Amazon?
Yeah, I haven't done it yet. But the title of the book is what tells the story. It's just full of data from all over this country, and it's inequality for all. Yeah. Basically, our system is set up to be unequal to kids, even of the same demographic, living in a much the same kind of community. There is no guarantee they will be given the same fundamental opportunities to learn math and science. And to me, that's a serious problem. That's the Achilles heel to No Child Left Behind. It's the Achilles heel to what is the right vision that we should leave no children behind.
I'll look forward to the book.
Me too. We'll have one final question, Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate your testimony, Dr. Schmidt. It's very inspiring. I come to this question more just from a parent point of view. And in my two children, one is in high school, sophomore, starting with geometry, and the other is sixth grader. We've had a wide swing in curriculum direction in our schools, and this is something I've struggled with as a parent. And looking at the charts and that you put up and what the approaches were in curriculum for my kids in their younger elementary years and now the expectations for high school, I do see a disconnect there with I see math really as a language and building blocks, and we went through a real sea change in our school from really a de-emphasis on learning number sense and the basic facts, and honestly we're playing catch up and now moving back to a more what I consider traditional curriculum. Could you comment on that and what kind of research you may have there?
Yes, I can. I might be glad to. There are a lot of data about this. This is what's called the math wars, what you're referring to, which is the battle between traditional as thought of, which is you learn the multiplication table, versus the new reform, which is you need to learn how to think analytically and do problems and things of that sort. You know, with most of these silly debates, the solution, the real answer is right up the middle. You can't solve problems until you understand the mathematics that you're going to apply to the problem. Problem solving in the abstract is one of the dumbest ideas we've ever come up with. And so it was advocated for quite a while. Solve problem. What problem? Problems. You've got to learn how to problem solve. Well, that just doesn't work. I can solve a problem if you give me the problem, and I know the math content that goes with the problem. And that's where it lies. So I think we're getting past that. The National Math Panel came out down the middle. I think the answer, you're right, we are behind in a certain way because for a while that was no longer advocated that we needed to memorize multiplication tables. But I think that's going away. But there are some kids who are caught in that because they probably still don't really know 6 times 5 like that. Because if you're going to do math, algebra, in the end of it, you've got to solve some algebra, you've got to solve some arithmetic operation. And if you can't do it, you're in trouble. So, sadly, you're right. But I think hopefully we're past that. And that's why coherence is important, because coherence says that should be learned in about third and fourth grade. Fraction should be learned second, third, and fourth grade, and then you build on that so that you move to the math. That's already, there's where also focus is important. Because if you just do a little bit of those things and keep repeating the same stuff, which we regularly do, the kids never get it. And so you keep repeating it. They cover it deeply, months. I'll give you a simple illustration. First, second grade, they only cover three topics. Number, including place value, simple operations, measurement units, and I've forgotten the third one. But there's only one other one. And that's why. It's place value, it's number operations, and it's measurement units. That's the whole of first and second grade, all year long. But when they leave first and second grade, they've got that, they can go on to the rest of math. we should be doing that. Your standards are more like that now. So you need to hold to those standards in spite of probably some pushback. You know, in this country, parents... How do I want to say this carefully? I won't say it. It's only in America where when two or three parents are gathered together and they come to the school to complain, that somebody pays attention to them. In the rest of the world, they say, we have standards. This is what the experts say is the progression of mathematical content. Thank you for your input. You know, but basically, here we think we have to make adjustments. And you have to change. You have to include a new section for kids that are above average. Well, here we're in Lake Wobegon territory. Everybody thinks their kids are above average, so they have to be in special classes. The pre-algebra in eighth grade, you know what that is? We studied it. We analyzed it. It's just a shock we give to middle-class parents. It's the same substance as regular math, but it's got a nice name because those kids quite aren't good enough to get in algebra, so we put them in pre-algebra. It's time we stop playing those games and really give all kids a solid grounding.
Dr. Smith, I wish we had another hour to spend with you. Thank you so much, and I look forward to continued association with you. Members, we're adjourned until Tuesday.